Okay, we're now in the June 2022 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. The page numbering starts over. First case under the heading Amendment of Answer, pages 4 and 5, Board of Managers of the Porterhouse Condominium. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to amend its answer to add additional affirmative defenses should have been granted. The two-year delay was not enough to show that plaintiff was prejudiced. Discovery was ongoing during that period. The court wrote, the court should have granted defendant's motion to amend its answer to add the four affirmative defenses of real property actions and proceedings law 1951. Adverse possession, mutual breach, and unclean hands, as leave to amend is freely given and plaintiff did not show that it would be prejudiced by the delay in asserting the defenses, citing CPLR 3025 subdivision B. While over 2 years had passed since defendant served its original answer, discovery was still ongoing. Plaintiff's claim of significant prejudice is unpersuasive, as all it points to is mere delay, which is insufficient to show prejudice. Nor did plaintiff rebut defendants showing that the proffered amendment is not palpably insufficient or clearly devoid of merit. So to reiterate, the defendant moved to amend its answer by adding affirmative defenses 2 years after the answer was served. Discovery was still ongoing at that point. The delay alone was not enough to demonstrate the plaintiff was prejudiced. Therefore, the motion to amend should have been granted. Next is Favorite Limited on pages 5 and 6. It deals with two separate issues. First, the power of the trial level court to amend the complaint, and the effect of an appellate ruling that dismissed the complaint prior to the Supreme Court granting a motion to amend it. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, a two-justice dissent, held that Supreme Court did not have the discretion to grant leave to amend a complaint which had been dismissed by the First Department for lack of standing. After the appeal, plaintiff had cured the standing defect, and Supreme Court allowed the amendment after the time period to commence a new action, that's under CPLR 205A, had expired. The court wrote, this appeal raises the interesting question of whether a trial court has the discretion to grant a plaintiff leave to amend a complaint pursuant to CPLR 3025 subdivision B, after the appellate division has already ordered the complaint dismissed with direction to enter judgment. We dismissed the complaint because plaintiffs, as non-managing members of the managed Delaware Limited Liability Company, lacked capacity or standing to act on behalf of the company when they obtained a certificate of revival of the company before filing a second amended complaint. After plaintiffs purportedly remedied this deficiency of proper standing, they sought to revive the dismissed action by seeking leave to file a third amended complaint. After we had already ordered the complaint dismissed, the motion court granted plaintiffs leave to file the third amended complaint. At the time plaintiffs sought leave to amend, the time to commence a new action had expired, including the six-month grace period provided by CPLR 205 subdivision A. We find that the trial court lacked discretion to grant plaintiffs leave to amend a complaint that had already been dismissed by this court. Given this court's outright dismissal of the claims based on a finding of lack of standing, there was no action pending when plaintiffs moved for leave to file the third amended complaint. The trial court lacked any discretion or authority to grant plaintiffs leave, where we had previously dismissed the second amended complaint before plaintiffs filed their motion to amend. So the takeaway here, Once the complaint was dismissed for lack of standing by the first department, there was no pending action. Once the time for commencing a new action under CPLR 205A had expired, the plaintiff was out of luck. Supreme Court did not have the discretion to grant plaintiff's motion to amend the complaint after it had been dismissed by the first department. Another decision dealing with the amendment of a complaint is on page 7, ALP Incorporated. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the action against the defendant Adam must be dismissed because the complaint was never properly amended to add Adam as a party. This action, the court wrote this, this action must be dismissed as against Adam because the complaint was never properly amended to add him as a defendant. CPLR 1003 requires leave of court or a stipulation by all parties to add parties, at least where, as here, parties have previously been added. CPLR 3025 subdivisions A and B similarly require leave of court or a stipulation by all parties to amend a complaint, at least when done so late in the case. Because this procedure was not followed, the amended complaint must be dismissed, at least as against to the newly joined Adam. So the takeaway here, the amendment of the complaint to add a party was not done by leave of court or a stipulation of all the parties. The action against the added party was dismissed on that ground. Next is Lopez, which is on page 8. It deals with compelling an independent mental examination. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to compel plaintiff to appear for an independent medical examination, or an IME, and to vacate the note of issue should have been granted. The court wrote, we find that plaintiff's mental condition is in fact in controversy. Plaintiff requests compensatory damages only for her alleged emotional distress, and she has testified that she experienced depression, anxiety, and dizziness, as well as headaches brought on by severe mental anguish. And it cited CPLR 3121 subdivision A. As a result, a mental examination by a psychiatrist is warranted to enable defendants to rebut plaintiff's causes of action for emotional distress. We grant defendant's motion to vacate the note of issue. Contrary to the certificate of readiness, discovery had not been completed as plaintiff had not yet complied with the court's directive to submit a Jackson affidavit detailing the process she had undertaken to search her social media post. So the takeaway here, plaintiff had placed her mental condition in controversy by testifying about depression, anxiety, dizziness, and headaches caused by mental anguish. The defendant was therefore entitled to compel a psychiatric exam, an independent medical examination. Here, the defendant's motion to vacate the note of issue should have been granted because defendant's discovery was not yet complete. Next is Wilner on page 9. It deals with an attorney who was not aware of certain procedures that have been put in place related to COVID. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the COVID-related law office failure was an adequate excuse and plaintiff's motion to vacate the dismissal of the action should have been granted. The court said, Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying plaintiff's motion to vacate the dismissal, as plaintiff showed both a reasonable excuse for their default and a meritorious cause of action, citing CPLR 2005. Law office failure constitutes a reasonable excuse for default here, since plaintiff's counsel was unaware that procedures for conducting compliance conferences had changed during the COVID-19 pandemic, and as a result, inadvertently failed to submit stipulations before a scheduled conference. Plaintiffs demonstrated a meritorious cause of action by submitting the complaint, a bill of particulars, and the injured plaintiff's deposition testimony. The defendants were not prejudiced by plaintiff's failure to appear and indeed did not oppose the motion to vacate. So the takeaway here, plaintiff's attorney was not aware of procedural changes related to COVID, and the action was dismissed because counsel didn't submit stipulations before the scheduled compliance conference in accordance with those new COVID rules. This law office failure was a reasonable excuse. Plaintiff's motion to vacate the dismissal should have been granted. Next, on pages 10 and 11, the Neuchel case. It's a trust and estates case dealing with a German holographic will, and whether New York would recognize that will is dependent on whether Germany was the decedent's domicile. So that was the issue that the court addressed. Third Department reversing surrogates court found that a hearing should be held to determine the decedent's domicile. Decedent was a world traveler who owned property in Germany and executed a holographic will in Germany. If Germany was his domicile, New York may recognize the holographic will. The court wrote, decedent was initially domiciled in New Jersey before he left the United States in 2014. Since decedent's domicile had been established, unlike mere physical residency, domicile is presumed to continue until a new one is acquired and is controlled by the subjective intent of the party claiming domicile. This determination generally involves questions of both fact and law and is based upon conduct manifesting an intent to establish a permanent home with permanent associations in a given location. Where there are particularly unique facts, like here with decedent being a perpetual world traveler, domicile is often a question of fact rather than law, and it frequently depends upon a variety of circumstances which differ as widely as the peculiarities of individuals. Domicile is particularly important where, like here, there is a petition to probate a holographic will. Although there are limited circumstances where a holographic will may be validly executed in New York courts may nevertheless accept holographic wills that are executed and attested in accordance with the local law of the jurisdiction in which the testator was domiciled, either at the time of execution or of death. In doing so, New York courts may take judicial notice of the laws of other countries and, as a matter of comity, may accept the findings of foreign courts, citing CPLR 4511 subdivision B. The record was incomplete and must be further developed as it relates to proceedings in Germany. We are concerned over the omission of the certificate of inheritance, which petitioner argues established the decedent's domicile in Germany. Such document may, if afforded comity, be dispositive. So the takeaway here, determination of a person's domicile is a question of fact and law, depending in part on the person's intent. Here, if Germany was decedent's domicile at the time the holographic German will was executed, or at the time of death, New York may recognize the German holographic will. The matter was sent back to develop a factual record on the issue of decedent's domicile. Next is matter of Sarah D. on page 12. It's a family law case dealing with whether a family court should have made certain findings so that the juvenile could apply for special immigrant juvenile status and remain in the United States. First Department reversing family court held family court should have found reunification with the petitioner's father in the Ivory Coast was not viable. Petitioner, who was 16 years old, asked for findings from family court which would allow her to apply for special immigrant juvenile status. That's SIJS, and remain in the United States. The court wrote, family court erred in not making any findings of fact as to reunification with petitioner's father. Exercising our power to review the record and make our own factual determinations, We find that the record supports a finding that reunification of petitioner with her father is not viable due to neglect within the meaning of Family Court Act Section 1012. Petitioner's testimony shows that the father did not meet the minimal degree of care since he did not provide for her medical and emotional needs while she was in the Ivory Coast and has not contributed to her financial support or maintained regular contact with her since she has been in the United States. Her uncontroverted testimony also supports a finding of neglect based on the father's excessive use of corporal punishment. So the takeaway, family court can be petitioned to make findings which will allow a juvenile to apply for special immigrant juvenile status in order to avoid deportation to the juvenile's home country. Here the court was asked to make findings that reunification with petitioner's parents is not viable. The first department found that father had neglected petitioner and she therefore could not be returned to his care. Next is Wells Fargo Bank on page 13, a foreclosure case that discusses the effect of a dismissal for lack of standing on the acceleration of the debt and therefore the running of the statute of limitations. The second department noted that the defendant in this foreclosure action did not demonstrate the foreclosure action was time barred. The initial foreclosure action was dismissed for lack of standing. Therefore, the debt was not accelerated by that prior action. Since the prior action was dismissed for lack of standing, defendant failed to establish that the plaintiff had the authority to accelerate the debt through the complaint filed in the prior action. So the takeaway here, if a prior foreclosure action was dismissed for lack of standing, that action will not be deemed to have accelerated the debt. That means the statute of limitations did not start running when that first action was filed, and therefore, in this case, the statute never started running and the subsequent foreclosure action was not time barred. Next is GMAC Mortgage on page 14. It's another foreclosure case. Here there was a 7-year delay between the order of reference and the motion for a judgment of foreclosure and sale, and the court ruled that the accrual of interest during that long 7-year delay should have been told. In other words, the bank cannot collect interest for that 7-year delay. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant was prejudiced by the unexplained 7-year delay between the order of reference in 2009 and the motion for a judgment of foreclosure and sale in 2016. Therefore, the accrual of interest during the delay should have been told. The court wrote, approximately 7 years elapsed between the entry of the order of reference and the time the plaintiff moved for a judgment of foreclosure and sale. Plaintiff failed to offer any explanation for this delay or establish that the defendant caused this delay, as the record demonstrates that the defendant's motions and the stays due to defendant's bankruptcy petitions did not occur during the period for which the defendant sought to toll the accrual of interest. Since the defendant was prejudiced by the plaintiff's unexplained delay of approximately 7 years, during which time interest had been accruing, the interest on the loan should have been tolled from October 9, 2009 until September 21, 2016. So the takeaway here, in this foreclosure action, the plaintiff bank could not explain the 7-year delay between the order of reference and the motion for a judgment of foreclosure and sale. The interest during that 7-year delay should have been told. The plaintiff is not entitled to interest for that time. Next is Bouchard on pages 15 and 16. It deals with the issue of governmental immunity, which raises the issue of whether the government was acting in a exercising a proprietary function or a governmental function at the time of the injury. This is a personal injury case. against the state by a harness racing driver who was injured by a collision during a race. The main issue before the court was whether the function of the state in controlling the harness racing was a proprietary function or a governmental function. If it was a governmental function, then the governmental immunity doctrine would apply. If it's a proprietary function, then normal negligence rules apply. The Third Department, in a comprehensive decision which should be consulted on the issues of governmental immunity, assumption of risk, and constructive notice, reversing the Supreme Court, held that the New York State Gaming Commission was exercising a proprietary, not governmental function when its employees inspected a harness racing horse, that was Mr. Miami's equipment, and failed to scratch the horse, which had exhibited indications he was lame from the and it should have been scratched from the upcoming race. The claimant was injured when during the race the claimant's horse collided with that horse that was alleged to have been lame, Mr. Miami, after Mr. Miami fell. Because the state's alleged negligence stemmed from a proprietary function, ordinary negligence principles applied, and there was no need to show a special relationship between the claimant and the state, and the governmental immunity affirmative defense was not available. There were questions of fact whether the assumption of the risk doctrine applied because the state may have acted to unreasonably increase the risk. As for notice, the regulations requiring the state to inspect the horses and equipment allowed the state's constructive notice of the dangerous condition to be imputed. The court wrote, "The duties of the state's officials are fundamentally intertwined with the operation of each and every race, and while such tasks may tangentially relate to the overall function of ensuring fair and honest gambling in this state, they are more specifically directed to the goal of ensuring the safety of the participants in those races. It is apparent that at least part of the commission's role in harness racing is to work hand in hand with the private racing industry to further the state's goal of deriving a reasonable revenue for the support of government. We find that there are tribal issues as to whether commission officials adequately perform their duties and whether their alleged failures unreasonably increased the risk beyond the level generally inherent in harness track racing. Because the inspection duties were imposed upon the commission officials by regulation, constructive notice of Mr. Miami's health and equipment issues that would have been observable during those inspections may be imputed to the state." So the takeaway here, this opinion has valuable discussions of 1, how to analyze whether a government is exercising a governmental function to which the special relationship and governmental immunity doctrines apply, or a proprietary function to which ordinary negligence principles apply. 2, the assumption of the risk doctrine, and 3, the imputation of constructive notice when there are regulations mandating inspections which allegedly would have revealed the dangerous condition. Here the claimant was injured during a harness race when his horse collided with a fallen horse. The complaint alleged the New York State Gaming Commission did not inspect the fallen horse and the fallen horse's equipment prior to the race as required by the relevant regulations. At this point, I'm going to insert the third verification code for this April, May, June 2022 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The third verification code to be put on your attorney affirmation is HARNESS. Again, the third verification code for this April, May, June 2022 Civil Procedure Update CLE is HARNESS. Next is FRANK on page 17. It deals with when trials should be held jointly. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's 2 separate traffic accidents should be tried jointly because plaintiff claimed the second accident exacerbated the injuries from the first accident. The court wrote, in view of the plaintiff's allegations that certain injuries which he sustained in the first accident were exacerbated by the second accident, in the interest of justice and judicial economy, and to avoid inconsistent verdicts, the two actions should be tried jointly. The respondents failed to demonstrate prejudice to a substantial right if the actions are tried jointly. Although the plaintiff moved to consolidate the two actions, the appropriate procedure is a joint trial, particularly since the actions involve different defendants. Next is Goldstein on page 18. The issue here was whether the defendant's motion to compel the plaintiff to accept a late answer should have been granted. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant did not offer a reasonable excuse for serving a late answer, which was rejected, in this slip and fall case. Defendant's motion to compel plaintiff to accept the answer should not have been granted. Defendant was served with the complaint on November 27, 2018, and the defendant attempted to serve an answer on January 9, 2019. The court wrote, the bare allegation by the defendant's attorney that the delay was caused by the defendant's insurance carrier is insufficient to excuse the delay in answering the complaint. The absence of a reasonable excuse for the defendant's default renders it unnecessary to determine whether she demonstrated the existence of a meritorious defense. So the takeaway here, the defendant attempted to serve an answer, which was rejected, about a month and a half after the plaintiff served the complaint. The defendant moved to compel the complaint to accept the answer. Defendant's excuse was that the delay was caused by the insurance carrier with no further explanation. The Second Department deemed the excuse insufficient and ruled that the motion to compel acceptance of the answer should not have been granted. Next is Incorporated Village of Freeport, pages 21 and 22. It's a contract action against a village, and it was dismissed because there was a requirement that a notice of claim be filed, and that requirement was not met. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's failure to file a notice of claim required the dismissal of its counterclaim, which was anticipatory repudiation of a contract against the village. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 9802, no action shall be maintained against the village upon or arising out of a contract of the village unless a written verified claim shall have been filed with the village clerk within 1 year after the cause of action shall have accrued. Statutory requirements conditioning suit against a governmental entity must be strictly construed. This is true even when the municipality had actual knowledge of the claim or failed to demonstrate actual prejudice. The plaintiff's exchanging of discovery and participation in the depositions of witnesses did not stop it from raising a defense pursuant to CPLR 9802, as mere participation in litigation does not constitute action calculated to mislead or discourage the defendant from filing a notice of claim. So the takeaway here, in a contract action against a municipality, here it was an anticipatory repudiation of contract counterclaim, a notice of claim must be filed, and that's pursuant to CPLR 9802. No notice of claim was filed here, and the counterclaim should have been dismissed. The fact that the municipality participated in discovery did not give rise to the estoppel doctrine because there was no intent to mislead the defendant with respect to the notice of claim requirement. Next is Matter of City of New Rochelle. It's on pages 22 and 23, and it deals with whether an issue is arbitrable, and if so, then the motion to stay arbitration should not have been granted. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held that the petition to stay arbitration in this General Municipal Law 207-A injury claim by a firefighter should not have been granted. The manner in which a Section 207-A claim is processed is an arbitrable matter. The court wrote, the union filed a grievance alleging that the city was in violation of the collective bargaining agreement and the negotiated General Municipal Law 207-A policy by failing to adhere to the required procedures in processing a claim by one of the union's members for General Municipal Law 207-A benefits. It is undisputed that there is no constitutional, statutory, or public policy provision prohibiting the arbitration of the dispute at issue in this matter. Given the breadth of the arbitration clause in this case, the dispute regarding the city's processing of claims for General Municipal Law 207-A benefits bore a reasonable relationship to the general subject matter of the collective bargaining agreement. Since Article 10 of the collective bargaining agreement expressly refers to the negotiated policy for the provision of such benefits, the question of the scope of the substantive provisions of the collective bargaining agreement is a matter of contract interpretation, and application is reserved for the arbitrator. So the takeaway here, the issue how a firefighter's General Municipal Law 207-A injury claim should be processed was addressed in the collective bargaining agreement and was therefore arbitrable. The petition to stay arbitration should not have been granted. Next is matter of Gabriel on pages 23 and 24. It's another late notice of claim case. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held that the petition for leave to file a late notice of claim should have been granted. The notice of claim was served 5 days after the expiration of the 90-day time limit. The court deemed that to constitute timely knowledge of the claim. The city didn't demonstrate prejudice, and the absence of an excuse was not a fatal defect. The court wrote, the petitioner served the notice of claim upon the respondents 5 days after the 90-day period for service had expired and commenced the instant proceeding the next day. Under such circumstances, the respondents acquired actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim within a reasonable time after the expiration of the 90-day statutory period. Since the respondents acquired timely knowledge of the essential facts constituting the petitioner's claim, the petitioner met his initial burden of showing a lack of prejudice. The respondents failed to come forward with particularized evidence showing that the late notice had substantially prejudiced their ability to defend the claim on the merits. The respondents' counsel made only conclusory assertions that the petitioner's 5-day delay in serving the notice had hindered the respondent's ability to conduct a prompt and thorough investigation of the subject incident, which were insufficient to rebut the petitioner's initial showing of a lack of prejudice. Although the petitioner failed to offer a reasonable excuse for his failure to timely serve the notice of claim, the absence of a reasonable excuse is not fatal to the petition where there was actual notice and absence of prejudice. So the takeaway here, notice of claim was served only 5 days late. The city was thereby deemed to have had timely notice of the nature of the claim, and the petitioner was deemed to have demonstrated a lack of notice, a prejudice on the city's part. The fact that the petitioner did not have an adequate excuse was not a fatal defect. So leave to file the late notice should have been granted. Next is R and G, Brenner, Income Tax Consultants, pages 25 and 26. It deals with the issuance of a preliminary injunction, the criteria for it. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held that the plaintiff employer's motion for a preliminary injunction in this violation of a restrictive covenant case should not have been granted. There were too many issues of fact about the nature of the party's agreement with respect to the plaintiff's purchase of defendant's tax preparation business, including whether defendant turned over her client list to the plaintiff. The court wrote, the plaintiff commenced this action against defendant, its former employee, to recover damages for breach of contract. The plaintiff alleged the parties entered into three agreements, a purchase agreement whereby the plaintiff purchased the defendant's tax preparation business, including her client list, an agreement whereby the plaintiff employed the defendant as a tax preparer, and a confidentiality, non-solicit, and non-compete agreement, which contained restrictive covenants that, among other things, prohibited the defendant from soliciting the plaintiff's clients. The plaintiff failed to demonstrate a clear right to relief, and thus did not demonstrate a likelihood of success on the merits. A restrictive covenant will only be subject to specific enforcement to the extent that it is reasonable in time and area, necessary to protect the employer's legitimate interests, not harmful to the general public, and not unreasonably burdensome to the employee. An employer's interests justifying a restrictive covenant are limited to the protection against misappropriation of the employer's trade secrets or of confidential customer lists, or protection from competition by a former employee whose services are unique or extraordinary. Here there are issues of fact as to what the parties agreed to, including whether the plaintiff purchased the rights to the defendant's clients pursuant to the parties' agreements, and whether the plaintiff breached its own obligations pursuant to those agreements. Since these issues of fact exist, the plaintiff did not show a likelihood of success on the merits and failed to establish a clear right to a preliminary injunction. So the takeaway here, where there are substantive questions of fact, a preliminary injunction should not be granted because the likelihood of success on the merits has not been demonstrated. Next is matter of DCH Auto Court of Appeals case, and it deals with the capacity to contest a tax assessment. The Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held that a tenant who is obligated to pay property taxes can properly file a grievance contesting a property tax assessment. The court wrote, Real Property Tax Law, Section 524, presents an ambiguity. The clause, quote, person whose property is assessed, close quote, is not defined by the real property tax law, and it lends itself to more than one reasonable interpretation. We hold that a grievance complaint filed with the assessor or Board of Assessment Review at the administrative level by a net lessee who is contractually obligated to pay real estate taxes on the subject property satisfies Real Property Law Section 524. So the takeaway here, clearing up an ambiguity in the real property tax law, Section 524, the Court of Appeals held that a tenant, called a net lessee, which is obligated by the terms of the lease to pay the property taxes, can file a grievance challenging the property tax assessment. The appellate division had held only the property owner could challenge an assessment. Next is ACE Security Corporation, pages 27 and 28. It's another Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals held that the plaintiff, HSBC, could not take advantage of the six-month extension for commencing an action after a dismissal which was not on the merits, that's in CPLR 205 subdivision A, because HSBC was not the original plaintiff. The court wrote, when a timely commenced action has been dismissed on certain non-merits grounds, CPLR 205 subdivision A allows the plaintiff in that action, or if the plaintiff dies, the executor or administrator of the plaintiff's estate, 6 months to commence a new action based on the same transaction or occurrence. The new action will be deemed timely based on the commencement of the prior action. Here, after the dismissal of a prior action brought by two certificate holders, and after the statute of limitations expired, plaintiff HSBC Bank USA, National Association, in its capacity as trustee of a residential mortgage-backed securities trust, commenced this action against the sponsor, invoking CPLR 205 subdivision A. Because HSBC was not the original plaintiff in the prior dismissed action, we agree with the courts below that HSBC could not invoke CPLR 205A to avoid dismissal of this time-barred claim. HSBC is not the plaintiff in the prior action, and the benefit of CPLR 205 subdivision A is unavailable to save its untimely complaint. This conclusion is consistent with the public policy undermining the savings statute. CPLR 205 subdivision A is a remedial statute that is designed to ensure to the diligent suitor an opportunity to have a claim heard on the merits when the suitor has initiated a suit in time, but the claim was dismissed on some technical, non-merits-based ground. While the savings statute undoubtedly has a broad and liberal purpose to ameliorate the potentially harsh effect of the statute of limitations, the important consideration is that by invoking judicial aid in the first action, the litigant gives timely notice to the adversary of a present purpose to maintain its rights before the courts. Whereas here, the litigant commencing the second action is not the original plaintiff, application of CPLR 205A would protect the rights of a dilatory, not a diligent, suitor. By failing to bring the action within the statute of limitations, HSBC signaled that it had no intention to pursue its claims in court. CPLR 205A does not apply, and HSBC's failure to commence an action within the statute of limitations is fatal. So the simple takeaway here is only the original plaintiff can take advantage of CPLR 205A, which allows recommencement of a lawsuit within 6 months of a dismissal which was not on the merits. Next is matter of Verdugo, pages 28 and 29. It's included here just because it mentions that there is an insanity toll to the statute of limitations. The First Department held questions about the incapacitated person's sanity should be part of the legal malpractice trial. If the incapacitated person is determined to have been insane at the time he was represented by the defendant attorney, the statute of limitations for the legal malpractice action would have been tolled. If not, the action was not timely. The court wrote, "The parties do not dispute that defendant attorney established that this action asserting breach of fiduciary duty and related causes of action, the malpractice action, was commenced after the applicable statutes of limitations had expired. However, plaintiff raised an issue of fact whether the statutes of limitations were tolled for insanity, and that's CPLR section 208 subdivision A. Viewed in the light most favorable to plaintiff, the record presents issues of fact as to the incapacitated person's ability to protect his legal rights and his overall ability to function in society at the time his claims against defendant attorney accrued." So the takeaway here, there is an insanity statute of limitations toll in the CPLR. Here there was a question of fact whether the incapacitated person was insane when he was represented by the defendant attorney, such that the legal malpractice statute of limitations was tolled. The final case in this April-May-June 2022 Civil Procedure Update, CLE, is on pages 29 and 30, matter of Sequino. It's a workers' compensation case, and it deals with what an appellate court will do if the record is inadequate. Third Department, reversing the Workers' Compensation Board, held that the board did not explain its decision to deny coverage of 25 medical bills based on the conclusion the bills did not relate to the claimant's medical condition. The court wrote, although the board has the exclusive province to resolve conflicting medical opinions and to evaluate medical evidence, and its factual determinations on a causal relationship will not be disturbed if supported by evidence in the record, its decision here fails to indicate what medical opinions or reports form the basis for the conclusions reached regarding the causal relationship. Many of the bills or supporting records include multiple diagnoses and charges, with some of the diagnoses appearing to match the established conditions, such as treatment for a urinary tract infection. No basis is provided for denying compensability for portions of the bills related to established conditions, that is, for denying payment for the entire medical bill based upon the inclusion of non-compensable treatment in the bill or records. By failing to provide the reasons for its rulings or the basis upon which the determination was made, the workers' compensation law judge and the board failed to satisfy their obligations to provide some basis for appellate review. So the takeaway here, when the workers' compensation law judge or the workers' compensation board fails to adequately explain its denial of coverage for medical bills that it concluded were not related to the claimant's medical condition, appellate review by a court is not possible and the matter will be sent back. You may have noticed that I skipped over some fairly important cases in the June reversal report, but that's only because I noticed that for some reason they were included in the May reversal report and I had already discussed them when we went through the May cases. So every case that's in the June reversal report has been discussed. All of the Court of Appeals cases that were released in April, May, and June of 2022 have already been covered in the CLE, but because I didn't separate them out and they're mixed in with all the other cases, I thought I would just take a couple of minutes and point out what the Court of Appeals has done in April, May, and June of 2022. In the April reversal report on page 5, is the matter of mental hygiene legal services case, which dealt with when an appeal is moot. There was a young girl who was difficult to manage in school, and the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities took her out of school but couldn't find a placement for her, and she ended up staying in a hospital emergency room for weeks. And the Mental Hygiene Legal Services brought a habeas corpus petition. But by the time the case went up to the Court of Appeals, she had been placed, and they had instituted a new procedure which was designed to prevent this problem from happening again. So the takeaway from this is an appeal may be dismissed as moot if the appellate court is presented with evidence the underlying issue has been adequately addressed while the appeal was pending. So the takeaway is, even though the case before the court might be moot, the facts have resolved themselves, an appellate court will still take the appeal if they think it's a problem that's going to recur and needs to be addressed. And the majority in this case determined that the regulations put in place while the appeal was pending would prevent this situation from happening again, and that's why the mootness doctrine was invoked. The only other Court of Appeals case in the April reversal report is on page 6 and 7. It's the Bonzar case, and it dealt with whether the appellate division's reversal of the granting of summary judgment to the plaintiff is an order which can be appealed to the Court of Appeals. It's a non-final order. So the question is whether it met the definition in the statute CPL 5501 as a non-final order that necessarily affects the final judgment. But because the order just reinstated the complaint and reversed the summary judgment awarded to the plaintiff, questions of fact remained up in the air, and those questions of fact were resolved by the jury at a trial. So the takeaway here is a non-final order is not appealable to the Court of Appeals unless it meets the definition of this phrase that's in the controlling statute, CPLR 5501. The phrase is, quote, affects the final judgment. If questions of fact remain after the non-final order is issued, the order does not, in quotes, affect the final judgment within the meaning of the statute, and therefore it's not appealable. Here, the non-final order was the appellate division's denial of plaintiff's summary judgment motion. The order left open factual questions to be resolved at trial. Therefore, the order did not fit the definition of that phrase, quote, affect the final judgment. There was only one Court of Appeals case dealing with civil procedure in May, and that's on pages 19 and 20 of the May Civil Procedure Reversal Report. And this dealt with what the requirements were for reviving the statute of limitations on a mortgage. And the Court of Appeals held that the statute of limitations on the underlying foreclosure action was not told based upon acknowledgments of the mortgage debt in financial statements and tax returns. Pursuant to General Obligations Law 17-105, only an express promise to pay the debt would revive an otherwise expired statute of limitations. So the underlying issue was which of two provisions of the General Obligations Law applied, and the Court of Appeals agreed with the Fourth Department and said that Section 17-105 applies, and therefore, absent an express acknowledgement of the debt, the statute of limitations is not revived. Here, the debt was mentioned in financial statements and tax returns that were given to the mortgagor, but that was not sufficient. There were two Court of Appeals cases in June. The first one is on pages 25 and 26 of the June Civil Procedure Reversal Report. That's the matter of DCH Auto. And the question there was, can a tenant who is obligated to pay the real estate taxes contest the assessment which determines the amount of that tax? The appellate division had said no, that only the property owner can bring a grievance contesting the tax assessment, but the Court of Appeals reversed and found that any tenant who is obligated to pay property taxes can properly file a grievance contesting the property tax assessment. And the last Court of Appeals case is on pages 26 and 27 of the June Civil Procedure Reversal Report. It's the Ace Securities Corporation case, and it deals with who can take advantage of the six-month extension to file an action which was timely filed but later dismissed, but not on the merits. So in a nutshell, only the original plaintiff who brought the original suit in a timely way can take advantage of that six-month extension. This was a case dealing with residential mortgage-backed securities. The initial action was timely brought by two certificate holders, and then the bank, I guess in its capacity as a trustee of the residential mortgage-backed securities, tried to take advantage of the CPLR 205 six-month extension for cases that are timely brought but dismissed not on the merits. But the Court of Appeals said that only the two certificate holders who brought the initial action could take advantage of the six-month extension. In other words, only the original plaintiff can take advantage of that six-month extension, and the action brought by the bank was deemed untimely. That concludes this April, May, June 2022 civil procedure update.